You're listening to Graveyard Show Classic.
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 Podcast number 2, January 8th, 2009.
Hi, I'm Stuart Hopewell, director of Slaughter, which is going to be in After Dark's 8 Films to Die For. And you can hear me on the Graveyard Show podcast.
To the graveyard.
And welcome to the second podcast of the Graveyard Show. I am your caretaker. The graveyard is open. So George Romero's trailer for Of the Dead is available online, and you can find that on any of your favorite horror websites. It's about a minute and a half to 2 minutes in length. This one looks a little bit more like Romero's earlier days. It looks a little bit more like the days of Night of the Living Dead, Martin, along those lines, The Crazies. Kind of has that earlier Romero feel. So definitely check it out. It's worth your time. And I know many of you out there are really looking forward to seeing this. I know I am. And the trailer is available. So take a look. Check it out. Meanwhile, Dread Central has an interview with Sid Haig, and he talks about his new movie called Dark Moon Rising. You should definitely check it out. I was on there earlier, and it looks as though they are having some website issues. So I'm not sure how long it's going to take. Based on what I could tell, it seems like they can't put anything new on. Hopefully they'll be back up and running. Meanwhile, Shock to You Drop had some interesting news on there. One of the interesting stories that I found on there is that Paramount is doing a fan commentary for the Friday the 13th 4, 5, and 6 DVD releases. And on part 4, Adam Green and Joe Lynch will be doing the fan commentary on that. For Friday the 13th part 5, Uncle Creepy, Steve Barton, and Stacey Lynn Wilson will be doing the commentary for that. And for 6, Ryan Rotten and Uncle Creepy, Steve Barton, will be teaming up for fan commentary on that. Certainly looking forward to the re-release of the Friday the 13th original films. I'm not sure how many of you know this, but regarding Part 3, which was shot in 3D, that is going to be released on home video in its original 3D format. And I'm just curious, for those of you out there that may be old enough to remember, back in the 70s and early 80s, there was sort of a resurgence in 3D filming. Jaws 3, Amityville 3, Friday the 13th Part 3, or some that come to mind. They were done in 3D, and now we're starting to have a resurgence again in 3D filmmaking, with this year with My Bloody Valentine opening up on the 16th of January, Friday the 13th Part 3 being released in 3D, the Night of the Living Dead film that was remade with Sid Haig about a year and a half ago, that was 3D as well. So I'm curious, for those of you out there that are listening, is 3D something that will get you to go into the theaters? Is that something that will entice you to see the movies even more? Or is it something that, when it's released on home video, would it get you to rent that movie? Or would you be more interested in seeing it at home in 3D than going and spending anywhere from $10 to $15 a ticket to see it in the theaters? For me, I'm not really sure. I was never a big 3D fan to begin with, but I have to say, I'm really interested in seeing what the Friday the 13th film is going to look like in 3D. I'd never seen it in the theaters in 3D. I saw Jaws 3 in 3D, and, you know, it was okay. The problem that I have with 3D filmmaking is that there are a lot of gimmicks that are done in the movie that just doesn't seem to work. People pointing in your direction, you know, in the movie, or water firing in your direction, things just flying at you. It always seemed like a gimmick that it needed to be done in order to get you to feel that 3D effect. What does interest me in 3D filmmaking is the perspective, having that depth. That I like. I just don't like the gimmicks of, you know, stuff flying at you. I never thought that really needed to be done. I get it, but it's just not something that I would rush to the theaters for. I will go see My Bloody Valentine because I want to see what the new 3D effects are like in the theater. And it's just something that it is curious for me, but I don't know if that's something that I would want to go see time and time again. In home video news, Midnight Movie was released on January 6th, this past Tuesday, on DVD. I hope you went out and got a copy. I hope you've seen it. If you have, let me know. Also, The Alphabet Killer was released on DVD as well this past week. If you've seen these movies and you want to comment on them, please send me an email at caretaker@graveyardshow.com. That's caretaker@graveyardshow.com. Of course, the big news this week is the 8 Films to Die For, the After Dark Horror Fest, is starting on Friday the 9th of January, and it's going to run through the 15th. And I also want to give you a programming note. Normally, the podcast of The Graveyard Show will be a weekly podcast, but since this week is the After Dark Horror Fest, and I was able to speak with Adam Girosh, who is the director of Autopsy, I didn't want to wait until next week to run the podcast. I figured it would be better to have it going during the After Dark Horror Fest. So please check the website, graveyardshow.com. That's graveyardshow.com. And I will be putting programming notes up. Adam's interview with me will be a separate show, and it will be up earlier than Thursday. So just not sure when yet. Also, speaking of Adam, he and his writing partner, Jace Anderson, will be showing up at Dark Delicacies this coming Sunday. I believe it's at 2 p.m., and they're going to be signing Autopsy posters. So if you live in the L.A. area, you should definitely go by and say hello. Who knows? Maybe I'll be there as well. Check Dark Delicacies' website for the date and time. And if you do go and see them, let them know that you're going to be listening to them on the Graveyard Show podcast. I'm sure they get a big kick out of that. Adam was nice enough to take time out of his day to sit down with me and talk about his film Autopsy. Also, I hope you all get to go out and check out the Film Fest. Again, it starts on January 9th. I would give you the list of cities, but I think it would be a little bit too long and take up too much time. So the website for the Horror Fest is the horrorfestonline.com, horrorfestonline.com. Check it out, and there is a list of cities and theaters in those cities where the After Dark Horror Fest will be taking place. According to the website, they're constantly updating it. So any information that I could be giving you now could be either old or outdated. So check out the After Dark website and check out the dates and what films will be playing on what days in your area. Hopefully all of you will be able to get out and support our independent filmmakers. Well, as you hear in the distance, the grave digging has begun. That grave is for my next guest.
Slaughter is one of this year's 8 Films to Die For in the After Dark Horror Film Festival. Its director, Stuart Hopewell, joins me in the graveyard. Stuart, thank you for joining me.
Hey, no problem. Appreciate it.
Your film and the film Perkins 14 not only are included in the After Dark Horror Fest this year, they are also the first two films to be not only distributed, but also produced by After Dark Films. How did you wind up getting your film produced by After Dark Films?
Well, you know, it ended up being kind of one of those random Hollywood stories. Uh-huh. I had been out in L.A. for about 4 years, and the script I actually wrote probably 3 years into being out in L.A., and I wrote it with a co-writer, Tim Long, who actually lives in Florida. And so we wrote it and shopped it around town a bit, and a lot of people liked it, but it was always kind of the same case, and you hear this a lot, where, you know, love it, it's just not right for the company right now. So okay. We sent it around to a bunch of producers, and Errol Cochran was working at a construction company, really liked it, but again, it wasn't right for a place. Anyways, January 2008, she gives me a call out of the blue, and is like, hey, you still have that script? And I'm like, yeah, I do, sure. You know, soon after that, we ended up having a meeting with After Dark, because she had just started working at After Dark as a freelance consultant with them.
Okay.
And she thought it'd be perfect for Horror Fest, so that's kind of how it happened. It wasn't through my agent. It wasn't through anything. It was just kind of networking.
Now, for those that may not be familiar, that have not gone onto the After Dark website to see what your film is about, why don't you tell us what your movie Slaughter is about?
Well, I can't tell you too much.
Yes.
I don't want to give away some juicy bits, but it's a story about two girls, Faith and Lola, who become fast friends. And Faith ends up actually moving out to Lola's family farm. And more of the reason she does this is Faith has been kind of bouncing around from town to town on the run from her abusive ex-boyfriend. And she thinks he might be catching up to her, so she's basically, put it bluntly, kind of hiding out on Lola's farm. But her and Lola are becoming friends, and over the first bit of the movie, we really just kind of see how their friendship develops, and we also learn a little bit about Lola's family through Faith's eyes, and Faith begins to realize that that Lola's family's maybe not all they're cracked up to be. She meets them. There's a dad and two brothers. The mom passed away a couple years ago. She meets them in there. And they're, in a word, creepy. And then things start to happen on the farm where Faith realizes that they're maybe a little bit more than creepy. They might be violent and specifically abusive towards Lola. And, you know, Faith coming from this past of abuse herself can really relate to that. And you know, she's become friends with Lola. So one night she sits Lola down and offers basically to help her kind of run away. Faith says she's leaving the next day. Lola, why don't you come with me? Lola is ecstatic about this. I mean, it's kind of the way out that Lola's been looking for. And they decide to run away. But before they do, bad things happen on the farm. their escape isn't as easy as they thought it would be.
What prompted the title change from Faithless to Slaughter?
Well, the script actually was originally entitled Slaughter. And what happened was... it was a couple of things, really, but there was another project called Slaughter that was kind of, I guess it was greenlit at the time we were thinking about doing ours.
Okay.
And I didn't really want there to be any confusion. I kind of knew the other director, not personally, but through a friend, and I just didn't want to, like, be that guy.
Sure.
And, you know, trying to jump on his movie and stuff. And so we changed it to Faithless, which is, like, this really... bad pun on Faith's name. And then basically by the end of it, the production company and I agreed, you know, we decided to change it back to Slaughter for a couple of reasons. One being that I think the other movie maybe isn't happening at all or as soon as we thought it would be. And B, it's definitely a much more impactful title. And after seeing the final cut of the film, kind of appropriate.
Your film and Perkins 14 both were shot in Romania. So my question is, was this the first time that you've ever worked on a movie outside the United States?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It was a trip and a half. Romania is a very cool place. Very interesting place.
There's certainly a lot of movies being made there.
Yeah, there was definitely, I mean, our movies were low budget, but there was at Media Pro Studios there were some really big budget movies being shot, and you know I'd be walking around and see Demi Moore and Josh Hartnett hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit of a trip, but it was very very cool environment to be in.
What kind of shooting schedule were you looking at for your movie?
We were looking at we ended up shooting I think 21 days.
Okay.
Which was okay. I was kind of going into the whole process expecting 24, and we had to shift things around a little bit.
Sure.
Which was fun, and then we did about a day and a half of U.S. pickups.
Okay.
In Atlanta, which was great, and it was actually really funny because that was the first time on the entire movie that I had been on set where people were speaking English. So, that was kind of wild.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, certainly working with the locals in Romania, what kind of language barrier did you have in terms of being able to, as director, getting your point across to getting what it is that you needed for your movie?
Well, all the key people could speak English really well. Our UPM and the first AD were very fluent. Mm-hmm. The production designer, equally fluent. And most of the other people could speak English reasonably well and much better than I could speak Romanian. Mm-hmm. I think growing up in that country, it's a very natural thing for them to learn language or English as a second language. I guess the biggest struggle, and it wasn't a struggle at all, really, but it was interesting, is that we used this great DP from Romania, and he's a Romanian. His English was pretty good, but it wasn't the best, and so there was a really interesting relationship that developed between he and I, where at first I was trying to figure out how to say things kind of like really particular and like trying to use words that like I knew he'd understand, and eventually like I realized that was all kind of a stupid way to go about it, and we actually really understood each other pretty well, and by the end of it I was our communication was perfect.
Sure.
It was challenging, it was a little scary maybe at first, but halfway through or by the end, it was absolutely fine.
I was going to say, because based on what I've seen from your movie 3 AM, which we'll get into a little bit later, you're quite a visual director, so I'm sure it was very important for you to really be able to communicate with your DP.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's something I really enjoy a lot about filmmaking. What was really interesting, just to contrast the two, is that with 3 AM, we were shooting probably like 2 pages a day,
mm-hmm.
and with Slaughter, we were shooting minimum 4.5 pages a day. One day there was like 9.5 pages on the call sheet.
Wow!
So I like to think that we maintained a very cool visual style for the movie, but kind of keeping in mind the scheduling situation we're in. I think we shot this a little different than how I approached shooting 3 AM, where
sure.
I knew I had time. This was more of a kind of verite, a lot of handheld, a lot of just kind of winging it type of shooting. We had 2 cameras rolling at all times, and just got really creative. I had ideas for the camera crew, but the 2 operators, I just let them kind of do their thing and supervise. And it's kind of the way we had to do it. Hopefully next time we'll have a little bit more time to plan stuff out.
Sure, yeah, because for those that are listening that aren't familiar with filmmaking, a 9-page day is an enormous amount of work. I mean, a movie of the week is an 18-day shoot, and that's for a 90-minute movie. But that's a lot. And for a feature film, I know that a 21-day shoot is quite an undertaking.
It was stressful, but it was a good type of stress.
Which film was shot first, yours or Perkins 14?
Mine was shot first.
Okay, so basically you got to warm the crew up.
They had fresh legs, which was kind of good. I didn't stay on for Perkins, and
sure.
I actually haven't seen the film, so I don't know much about it. We did share the crew.
Okay,
for sure.
Has After Dark talked to you at all about possibly doing anything down the road, or are you just moving about on your own right now, just pursuing projects outside of? Or with other studios, I should say.
Well, it's a little bit of everything, to be honest. After Dark, I've had conversations with them where they're very happy with the way this film came out, and I think as being one of the first films that they've kind of made on this level for this festival, it's definitely like their baby as it is much mine, and I think they're really pleased with the way it turned out. Now, logistically, in terms of me like maybe doing a film for next year's festival, there's just kind of all sorts of political things regarding that, like the scripts that they might finally get for next year's festival maybe already have directors attached,
mm-hmm.
things like that, but I know that they at least what they've told me, they're interested, but nothing firm yet. In terms of other things, there are a couple projects that I am attached to direct, but they don't have financing as of yet. One is a kind of a dark creature feature that Stan Winston actually was behind, and that was actually probably one of the coolest parts of being attached to the project, and that happened really shortly after I moved to LA, as I got to meet and develop a bit of a working relationship with Stan Winston.
That must have been special.
It was super special. I remember the first time I went into his offices, and he has his conference room is this showroom, and you're sitting at this conference table, and like you look around, and like Terminator's mm-hmm. like drawn down on you with a shotgun, and then there's a raptor hanging out in the other corner, and you're just like, oh my god, this is the best toy store in the entire world.
But, filmmaker's paradise.
Oh, it seriously was. It was ridiculous. But anyways, since he's passed, Rachel Bilofsky, who runs Screamfest, which is a big horror festival in Los Angeles, owns the rights and is producing on it. And so we're working together to try to set up some financing for that. There's this erotic thriller that is really cool, kind of like Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction, that I'm working on with Errol Cochran, who is one of the producers on this film. And we're looking for financing for that. And then I got a couple writing things that I'm doing.
Fantastic. Sounds like you're very busy. So you're an East Coast guy, now living on the West Coast.
Yeah.
How do you like it?
I like it. Yeah. I think everybody goes through the same thing, where East Coast is, like, I grew up in Virginia.
It's cold in Virginia.
It is. And it gets real hot and humid.
Yep.
But in and around D.C., and it's just a different vibe. Coming here, though, it was like, I don't know, everybody goes through the thing where, like, oh, everybody's a little superficial, everybody's a little odd and strange, but after being here for 5 years now, I like it. I like the weather. I like it not.
Yeah, it's not bad being able to wear shorts in November, December while the rest of the country is freezing.
Mm-hmm.
That's for certain. So what were your influences growing up? What actually got you to the point where you said, I want to make movies for a living?
You want the long story or the short
story? Sure, yeah, whichever's easier for you.
All right. Let's see. When I was real little, I loved David Copperfield. I was like, oh, I want to be a magician. And then as I got a little older, I was like, oh, movies are really cool, and they kind of do magic in movies a lot. So I was like, okay, I want to work for, and then I loved, like, you know, the Star Wars movies. And so I was like, all right, I want to work for Industrial Light and Magic and be a special effects guy. And then as I kind of got to figure out movies a little more, I'm like, well, wait a second, what does a director do? And then I realized that the director kind of gets to play in all the areas of filmmaking, and so that's one thing that really attracted to me to it. But at that point in my life, I was actually going to school for I was doing a double major in computer science and art and art history, so I was kind of bound for a cubicle. A friend of mine, one of my best friends, we decided to do an independent study while I was in college, and we were like, you know what, let's get a video camera, let's make a movie. And I was like, well, I have a computer, I know how to use that. And we'll edit it, and it'll be great. And we made this kind of epic, like, half-hour-long short that involved a guy, like, kind of being a sleazeball on campus and hooking up with girls, and we thought it was, like, awesome. And everybody at school loved it, and they thought it was awesome, too. And looking at it now, it probably could have been about 5 minutes long. Anyways, that we made that first short and realized that after doing that, I realized, you know what? I actually really enjoyed that process, and I really enjoyed, like, people watching it and, like, responding to it, either good or bad. You know, it was just really cool. And so decided to go to film school after that at Florida State University, graduate film school. And that was and got in there. They're pretty rigorous with their screen process. So that was just cool to get in there. And then from there, it was just kind of a downward spiral.
On your website, you had mentioned, and I don't know where this falls in terms of your time in college, but you wrote on your website that at one point you want to write a screenplay about an experience that you had where you were in Brazil and you were kidnapped. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing some of that with us, and what exactly happened, and how did that affect you?
I can talk about parts of it.
Sure.
Well, I was down there I was working as a camera operator, and basically, the crew, we had these, like, security guards. It was weird going down to Rio, and I was in Rio de Janeiro, and we had these security guards that came with us all times, who were, like, packing Uzis in their coat pockets and, like, guarding us, and that was kind of weird. And I was like, oh, this must be kind of a dangerous place if we need security guards. What ended up happening is, I think one of the security guards, like, was friends with a police officer in, like, a precinct, like, 2 hours away. And he basically told his friend that there are a bunch of Americans who had a lot of money, which we didn't, who were there, who they could kind of take advantage of. And I'm not to hate on Rio or Brazil, because the people there are amazing, but the government is very corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of two levels of police. There's the civil police,
mm-hmm.
which are basically thugs. And then there's the federal police, who are more military.
Okay.
And basically, in the middle of the night, these civil police from 2 hours away came and arrested us on a noise complaint for completely fraudulent charges. Like, just
sure.
ridiculous charges that are...
Just made up. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a scene. And so we ended up being detained, like, driving down this dirt road for 2 hours. I thought I was going to die. And being detained for 3 days while they slowly kind of extorted money out of us.
Wow.
And we went through like three lawyers, all of who were like taking cuts from the bribes. It was just an insane.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going through like, it was an insane process. And we eventually kind of got out of it. Paid most of the money, and then they kept our passports, and we made our way back to Rio, and we had to deliver like 20 grand in cash to them, which was delivered, and then they still didn't give our passports back, and we had to, like, the U.S. Embassy had to send one of their I guess you could call them specialists to go strong arm our passports back.
Wow.
But it was, I mean, in retrospect, it was just kind of a, I mean, there's a lot kind of more details to it, but it was definitely a nerve-wracking kind of surreal experience. It's actually funny, like, in the middle of the night, they drug us all up into this room and had like 50 reporters taking pictures of us.
Oh my gosh.
For the newspapers. And I was like, because we didn't do anything wrong, so I'm just like, why are these reporters taking pictures of us for like some made-up story? But apparently the reporters pay the police for their stories. So the police were just making a buck on this, and they're like, yeah, guys, go for it.
Wow.
And I ended up in a lineup, my picture on the front page of, 4 out of the 5 major, Brazilian newspapers in a country of 180 million people.
I mean, your parents must have just been horrified.
Terrifying. It was terrifying for them. It was terrifying for my family. It was terrifying for friends. And while it was happening, though, I wasn't really, strangely enough, scared. It was just very surreal. I was just kind of like,
yeah,
all right, I guess this is really happening. Just kind of going through the paces. And then we eventually, like I said, got out. We're waiting for our passports, which took a while to get there. And then
I bet you couldn't wait to get back home.
Yeah. So I want to write a little script based on it, but I'm just trying to figure out if we have to shoot in Rio or not.
Yeah.
I'm allowed back.
Well, let's move on to a little bit of a lighter subject, although I don't know if this is really lighter, but your film 3 a.m. that you shot while you were at Florida State, which, by the way, if no one has seen that, they can go to your website, stuarthopewell.com, and there is a link to the movie. And it's about 22 minutes in length, I think, right?
Yeah, we had to keep it to a reel.
So here you make this movie. It was 2003, right?
That's right.
And here it wins Best Student Film at Scream Fest LA. It wins the ASC Heritage Award for Cinematography. You won a Student Emmy for it, and then it was featured in American Cinematographer magazine. I mean, talk about what a way to be ushered into the world of professional film. I mean, this must have been just complete elation for you to have all this acknowledgement for your work.
It was awesome. It was completely awesome, and I guess a little, I mean, nobody can expect it, but it's definitely unexpected. It was just kind of, I mean, we just made a movie that we thought would be cool and interesting, and it was just really, really nice that people responded to it the way they did. And I think one of the things about it was that the film school at Florida State, at the time, for the graduate program, there's 24 people in the class. They only made 5 graduate thesis films.
Okay.
So they were able to pour a lot of money into them. And and they did. So it had, for a student film, a pretty professional look and feel to it. Coming
it
out
definitely
of
did.
Tallahassee, Florida.
I mean, I was watching this on your website, and this looked like something that was produced by a studio. Do you want to give away or tell what it is so people have an idea?
Graham is about basically a third or a late shift crematorium worker who is this lonely guy who basically takes advantage of one of the bodies that he's going to burn, which is a woman and a young woman who mm-hmm. has died way too soon.
Mm-hmm.
So he does that, and then he kind of throws her in the oven, or retort as it's called in the business, to burn. And while she's being burnt, her ghost kind of supernaturally comes back and exacts her
revenge. Now, where did you get the idea for the film?
You know, it wasn't a terribly organic idea in that I thought of it just like it didn't just come to me. I think what happened was we were thinking about ideas for these thesis films and what could mine be. And I had done, I guess you could say, thrillers as my other short films. And I kind of wanted to stick with that. And I just started thinking about like a night watchman, like what could he, you know, what happens on the night shift, you know, mm-hmm. give a short film, like a contained space and contained amount of time, and just see what could happen. And then, you know, at the time, Supernatural, like films were really kind of big, like the J-horror thing was happening.
Yep.
Before into that. We started thinking about like, all right, what if he's haunted and blah, blah, blah. And then it kind of came down to, well, why don't we make the film really edgy and make it so even if it's bad, people still like kind of talk about it
mm-hmm.
at least, and it will get some attention that way. So we just kind of went to the darkest part we could with the molestation and necrophilia,
yeah,
and which is done in a very tasteful way.
I know that there are films that are done specifically to exploit violence and gore because there is a market for that. On the other hand, there is obviously there are ways of doing violence, like Romero did when he did the zombie movies, and there's a way not to do violence. So I was curious, how do you go about that? Do you have a philosophy for that, or have you encountered that?
I'm not a huge like gore fan. I don't really like my favorite horror movies are like Rosemary's Baby and The Shining and things like that, where.
Uh-huh.
I enjoy like the slasher movies.
Yes.
But it's not really like my go-to thing. So, I guess there's a couple angles to this answer. First of all, is it easier to direct one way or the other? It's easier to direct the less bloody stuff
mm-hmm.
just for the sheer fact there's less blood. And when you're on set, I mean, that stuff, if you have to go for another take, you have to clean stuff up, and it just takes time, and it's just kind of this random element of dealing with blood and, like, you know, putting makeup and prosthetics, and it just takes
longer.
Time.
And, it also bogs down the filmmaking process where you're shooting an eighth of a page, you know, 12 hours, and it's you're not getting very much done.
Exactly. But for Slaughter, just to kind of say this, because the name does kind of steer you in one direction, and that is, it isn't so much a slasher film. It really isn't. It's
mm-hmm.
It's more of a thriller, and I would argue not to set expectations too high, but that the first half of it is much more like Hitchcock than a slasher film. I mean, it's about these two girls developing a friendship, getting to know each other, and seeing Faith kind of investigate around the farm and trying to figure things out. And then at the midpoint or a little bit later, it takes a turn and it turns into a foot race from there on out. But even with the violence that does occur after that, it's, I mean, it's gory, I guess, but it's not, and this is really hard for someone who was there on set to like really objectively think about, but it's not like, I don't think, too bad.
Okay.
Or it's not exploitive, I would say.
Okay.
I think we tried to definitely go with less is more,
sort of leaving it up to the audience to kind of play.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely show certain things happening that are kind of brutal, but I mean, less is more, I think, is always a good choice. I mean, you look at a movie like the classic kind of example is, there's lots, but like Alien, for instance, or Jaws. Jaws is kind of a classic example, but you know, they don't show the shark that much, and it's scary. So less is always good. Less is more is always a good kind of philosophy, and we deal with that. Also, when you're dealing with a low budget, it's cheaper.
Yeah, true. What advice would you have for anybody that may be looking at getting involved in the film industry, maybe in high school or beginning college, or maybe even just getting ready to leave college? Do you have anything that you might be able to pass along to them that they may... It doesn't necessarily even have to be about directing, but just anything in general.
Yeah, well, I mean, come to L.A., or New York if you can't come to L.A., but those are, you know, it's like a numbers game, and you have to go where... What's the phrase? Like, if you want to fish, you have to go to the ocean or something like that. I mean,
yeah.
It's you're not giving yourself the best chances if you don't come to L.A., or at the very least, New York. So I would say that's number one. Number two is give yourself at least 5 years in L.A. My story is a perfect example of that, and what was really interesting about that and the five-year mark is that kind of when mine happened like after I was there for about 4 years and a bit, but I look around at the friends of mine who I went to film school who also came out here, and the ones that are doing really well, they kind of got their feet and got the jobs that they got around like the 4 and 5 year mark too. Like I had three other friends who made feature films around the same time I did, and they had been trying since they had come out here. So definitely don't give up. Give yourself at least 5 years, if not more. And then thirdly, there's a lot of competition out here, and I think one of the best things about at least going to film school, but you don't have to go to film school to do this, but you need to come out with material, whether it's a short or what the much better combination is. And even if you have a really great short, you'll probably be told that you need to do this anyways, is you need to have a short and a feature screenplay that you wrote, because that's just kind of the way it works out here. And also representation. Agents are interesting creatures, and they don't really want to deal with you if they don't have something that they can sell. So you might have an awesome short, but then it's like, well, that's great, but you know, come back to me when you have a script that's based on your awesome short that I can sell. I mean, if you want to be a director, that's definitely...
You got to really put your time in, definitely.
Yeah, and you have to be prepared. I mean, it's a business, so they want stuff to sell. If you want to do, like, camera operating or DPing and stuff like that, I mean, it's the same process. You have to come out here and pay your dues. And if you were an awesome DP in college, you know, at your film school, and you come out here, unless you're really lucky, you're going to start as, like, a, you know, on the bottom of the ladder again. So, you know, you always have to pay your dues and just try, but it's definitely a smart move to come out to L.A.
Well, I'm curious, you're of the generation that really, I think, is now working with the new media a lot more than previous generations did when making movies. You certainly have Final Cut Pro, computers, Pro Tools, the Internet, YouTube. I'm just curious, from your perspective, where do you think you may be seeing films, or maybe not, but what do you think in terms of forecasting what movies will be like in the next, you know, 5 years or so, maybe a couple of years? Do you see that maybe there may be a trend towards something that... that may be new, or...
Well, I mean, everybody's jumping on the 3D bandwagon, which is kind of fun. I haven't seen any of the 3D movies that have come out, like Beowulf or I don't know, the other ones that have come out.
Yeah, Polar Express.
Yeah. I actually have a good friend who's in the My Bloody Valentine one that's coming out right after Horror Fest, so I will probably go see that one. But I mean, that seems pretty exciting, and that seems kind of like a natural progression. I don't know, it might be a little gimmicky right now, but I mean, it's pretty cool to go to a movie theater and see it in 3D.
Even Paramount is doing that now when they're re-releasing all the Friday the 13th movies, and Part 3, which was shot in 3D, they're actually releasing it on DVD in 3D, which is really interesting.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. So that's really cool. I mean, I don't know that films really from the audience's perspective will change too much over the next 10 years. From the filmmaker's perspective, I mean, I think digital will really take over. You'll have purists out there, but I just saw, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity to see it with, it was a Q&A, and David Fincher was there and his DP, who I'm blanking on the name. But the DP said, they shot that movie on the Viper, which is a digital camera, and it looked amazing, you know.
Wow.
And I never, while I was watching it, I didn't really think about whether it was shot in film or not, but it certainly, it looked fantastic. So, I mean, the capabilities of the Viper and especially the newer high-def cameras that are out there and are just fabulous, and like what kind of red cameras are doing right now with their brand new announced kind of modular build your own camera system is pretty fantastic.
A lot of prosumer gear out there for the filmmakers still going through the process of college and high school. They can just go home and cut their own movies and basically do everything.
Yeah, I mean, with the Red, you can get an incredibly, I mean, you can really get a professional package for a really reasonable price. I mean, it's still kind of expensive, but it's a lot better than what film or the other HD cameras cost. And with their new system, you can kind of upgrade parts of your camera independent of the others. So instead of, you know, if you want like more resolution, you don't have to buy an entire new camera. You just buy a new sensor. So it's pretty cool stuff.
He is the director of Slaughter, which will be one of the 8 films that will be a part of the After Dark Film Fest of 2009. It has been my pleasure to interview Stuart Hopewell. Stuart, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
And the After Dark Horror Fest will begin on January 9th, Friday, and it will run through the 15th. And I hope all of you are able to get out and to see at least some of these films while they're in the theaters. Now, before we close the graveyard down, for those of you that have visited my site in the past, graveyardshow.com, every Friday I like to post what's going to be on TV as far as horror films go. I call it the Friday Night Horror. So those of you that may be either staying home voluntarily or just find yourself looking for something on television, here are a couple of films that I came across that will be playing. All times are Eastern Standard Times. Some of you may have satellite television where you get the East Coast feeds. So American Movie Classics on Friday night will be showing Damien Omen 2 at 10:30 p.m. And they will be following that up with Omen 3, The Final Conflict, which will be on Saturday morning at 1 a.m. And then after that, they're going to be showing And Now the Screaming Starts, which starts at 3:30 in the morning, Saturday. Independent Film Channel will be showing Sisters at 8 p.m. Eastern. And on Saturday morning, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, will be on at around 1:35 in the morning. And Turner Classic Movies will be showing on TCM Underground, the original Amityville Horror, and that'll be on around 2 a.m. So there's some horror films for you if you happen to be home. Save you a little time. And as I conclude this second podcast of The Graveyard Show, I would like to thank you once again for joining me here. Please make sure you check my website, graveyardshow.com, for updated information, certainly with Adam's interview. And also, you just never know who may show up in the graveyard unexpectedly. So please make sure you check the website, graveyardshow.com, for any changes in dates and times, or to find out who my next week's guest will be. Again, my interview with Adam Girosh will be available earlier than a week from now. Just not sure what day yet, so please check the website, and I will let you know when the date and time is for that upload of the podcast. It will definitely be earlier than Thursday. And as you exit the graveyard, I would like to remind you, please, lock the gate behind you. We wouldn't want anyone to get out. Until next time.